Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you need to know about swine flu and how it's likely to affect you and the people you care about? With the first vaccine doses aimed at medical workers trickling into health departments around the country, experts remain braced for a season of infections unprecedented in the past half century. Joining us now to talk about what is happening in North Texas is Jory Klein. She is a registered nurse who directs trauma and disaster management for Parkland Health and Hospital System. Jory, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
How well are we able to track how widespread the virus is, given that a lot of people won't ever actually show up at a doctor's office or a hospital emergency room?
Well, there's some very sophisticated systems that the Department of Public Health, as well as the hospitals, have put in place. These systems track symptoms. For example, if you came into the emergency department and said, I have, you know, nausea, vomiting, I have fever, you're automatically tracked. And it's called, ours is called a red bat system, and there are several others that are out there. And so they track the prevalence, the incidence, the location. And so you can almost, you know, spot when there's an issue happening. The question is sometimes how frequently is that monitored and who's looking at it and who's making the decisions. And so obviously because this is a high acuity issue, our Department of Health, led by John Carlo, and all of the hospitals, their staff that deal with emergencies and infectious disease doctors are monitoring this. We've been monitoring this since April. We haven't stopped. I would imagine that this monitoring that we're involved in now will continue through, you know, next April or when we start seeing a decline. And we're learning a lot more about how to work together, how to communicate, how to share this information. And so I would say on a scale of 1 to 10, the Dallas community should be very lucky. I would rate us as a 9, would be able to monitor this and actually be able to respond to the needs of the community.
What can we expect in terms of the peak infection rate? Is there a way to predict when we'll get to that point where the most people who are going to be sick at one time are in fact sick in this area?
Well, it's interesting. Some people say we've already seen that with the children going back to school, the academic program starting back up. And then there's another group, that specifically if we're talking about the swine flu, that say it's going to hit a little bit later. And so there's two camps in that. So we're really embracing, we actually have seen some significant increases of the swine flu in the last month. Again, kids going back to school, you can almost track that spike that there's more exposures. And then we anticipate in late January, February, there may be another spike in that.
Mm-hmm. Schools are being just exceptionally vigilant right now. Mm-hmm. And there are some parents who are complaining that their kids are not don't have the flu, but are being sort of kicked out of school. Does it make sense, though, to say if there's any possibility that you have this, that you stay out for as long as you have symptoms?
Sure. I mean, last April, if people were exposed, they were closing down the schools to keep them from getting it. Now, if you hear school closures, it's not because they're trying to keep you from being exposed, because it's so rampant, you're exposed everywhere you go. You get on the bus, you're going to be exposed. You go to Tom Thumb, you're going to be exposed. People are in there, you're going to be exposed to it. So essentially what the schools are doing are trying to maintain some type of vigilance to keep people as healthy and as well as possible. I know in my own child's school, you know, the hand washing, I cannot stress to mothers enough, the hand washing is one of the simple ways to protect your child. So the other way is if you're a parent and you know your child has a fever, just simply don't send them to school. So that's really what the schools are after.
What have you seen in terms of we hear a lot about how infectious this disease is, but when a parent is caring for a sick child or a spouse or somebody, how likely are they to get the infection themselves?
Well, in the initial phases, they were like, if you were close proximity of 6 feet, then you're very likely to get that. Essentially, what we are learning as the disease progresses is that it's really exposed by droplets. So if anybody in the house has it, if you put a mask on them and you wash your hands, that's going to decrease your risk. The reality is, in most families, you know, space is not, I mean, nobody thinks about you're in my space. You're very close proximity. People share, you know, Cokes, drinks, and so that's how people get it. But in the school system and in the work environment, here's how you can protect yourself. First of all, don't go to work if you're sick. There needs to be a policy and an acceptance because, you know, if employees call in, most managers are like, well, you know, this is the third time you've called in this year. In this situation, we really want people to stay home if they're febrile and have a cough. So I think the bottom line is if you're within 6 feet of someone, you're at risk if they are definitely have the swine flu or you think they have the swine flu. The next issue is the droplets. So if they're coughing, they're sneezing, you're drinking after them, then you're definitely going to be at risk for being exposed to that. So if you have a mask, just simply put the mask on them.
On them. And that's an important point because some people think they should maybe walk around themselves to avoid getting sick. Mm-hmm. That's not nearly as helpful as getting the sick person isolated with a
mask.
That's
correct. That's mm-hmm. the way you want to do it. The person that's sick that's coughing out those droplets is who you want to put something over. Now, there is a group that's at high risk. And if there is anybody in the community that has immunosuppressed system, in other words, they can't fight disease, for example, somebody on chemotherapy, they may want to put a mask on. And those individuals are encouraged to really stay in their home and be cautious of individuals that visit them. So other examples, children or adults that have acute respiratory distress or chronic asthma that really have a hard time, they don't have a lot of lung resistance or resilience. Those are the individuals that are really encouraging to be, very vigilant in trying to protect themselves.
Are you seeing a really high incident rate for people who work in health clinics and hospitals? Are they catching this from their patients?
We have seen some conversions. I wouldn't say it's extremely high. In our environment, everybody was like, oh, the ER is going to be overwhelmed. The ER has seen an increase, but our community-oriented primary clinics led by Sharon Phillips has really taken the brunt of most of the individuals seeking health care, and they've done a phenomenal job at trying at responding to that. In 1 week, they evaluated the 700 flu tests. So that can just show you the spike, and now it's beginning to go down a little bit. We've had about 130 patients test positive. Again, there's a high incidence of people thinking they have it, and then when you go through the screening process, there's other issues that go on, and they don't have the swine flu. But in some cases, they do have the swine flu, and so again, the treatment, the most thing to be concerned about is exposure. Put a mask on them, treat their fever. Again, the recommendations is anybody that has a temperature of 102 needs to see a physician.
Jory Klein is my guest. She's a registered nurse and director of trauma and disaster management for Parkland Health and Hospital System. We're talking about swine flu in North Texas. If you'd like to ask a question, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jory, I want to talk about the vaccine because mm-hmm. there have been people who've been following this story have heard multiple accounts. You need two doses. No, you only need one. You can use the flu mist or you have to have a shot. Talk about what we know now in terms of the effectiveness of the medication that might prevent this disease and who needs to get it.
Well, let me just tell you this. The answer to this is sort of changing as we move forward, the more we know. So currently what is being recommended is that the highest risk patient population, as we know, are the smaller children and the pregnant patients. And then the individuals in the healthcare worker environment that are going to face those individuals as they present. So those are the individuals who are considered the high risk that they want to try to get that medication out to first. So and if you're just talking about Parkland's environment, we would look at those people in the COPC sites, and then we would look in our emergency department and obviously anybody in the jail system or situation like that. Now, the actual disease is impacting the very young children, which is very different. And most flu. Most flu, we tell people, from the very young to the very old are the people who usually get this. And so the recommendation is that the children should receive the H1N1 vaccination. The different ways to get that in the PD population are the mist as well as the shot. Now, the adult population who receive the shots, the recommendation has gone from getting two shots to one shot and then to be followed.
And the one shot is separate, though, from the one for seasonal flu.
That's very important to point out. Currently, all of the drug stores are helping us. Almost anywhere you go, you can find a flu shot. That is specifically to target the seasonal flu that we always see. The H1N1 vaccination is just beginning to arrive in our community. I know that the Department of Health received some of those. And again, their priority was to try to give that to the Department of Health workers that might be out there trying to help some of the other individuals that might be at risk. So that was the first dose, and they'll move that forward into the high-risk population.
Remarkably, this strain of the flu doesn't seem to be particularly bad for people who are in their 60s and older, which is really different from what we've seen in the past. Can you talk about the reasons why that might be the case?
Well, I can't give you all the scientific reasons, but you're right. The seasonal flu very typically hits the very young and the very old. So anybody that was over 60 years of age, and especially anybody that had any type of comorbid disease, was really highly encouraged and watched out to make sure that they didn't get the flu symptoms. What we saw in April was that this was almost reversed. And so the population that's typically getting it are the school-age children, the small children, the school-age children, all the way up into the college-age individuals. So a lot of the colleges have had major, you know, empty classes. So the other thing that they thought is there were going to be a lot of deaths in the swine flu versus the normal flu. In reality, the deaths that we're seeing aren't measurable to the regular flu. But the deaths that are occurring in two patient populations, and they are almost consistently, they are in individuals who already have some type of underlying health problem. Most commonly, the issue is something like COPD, acute asthma, renal problems, and things like this. So when the swine flu hits those individuals, their ability to respond to that and to fight that usually is overwhelming them. So in our community, I think we've seen about 3 or 4 deaths related to that. And it's a reason I can't give you the exact numbers is because some of those tests are still being rolled out. But the reality is, you know, again, those are the patients that we're most concerned about. The other patient population that's really different is the pregnant patient. This is the first time we have really taken a strong approach to trying to make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect that population. For some reason, they're extremely high risk. So one of the things that we typically see in the hospitals is anytime somebody's in the hospital, everybody wants to come and visit them. Well, if you think about a pregnant patient and they go into labor and they have a new baby, everybody wants to come see that new baby, right? So we've got to really teach the community, this is not when we want you to come and visit the baby. We're trying to restrict children from the maternity wards, and we're not trying to be mean to the families. We're really trying to protect that patient. So we're really asking, you know, individuals, first of all, if you have somebody that's ill, please don't bring them to the hospital. I mean, people are already in the hospital because they're sick. But if you're going to visit the hospital, please make sure that you don't have fever, you're not coughing, you're not bringing a child with you that is sick, because when they visit a pregnant mom, they're putting them at significant risk of exposure. And so that's the last thing that mom needs.
And I guess the reality is that a lot of pregnant women also have, you know, a preschooler running around or a school-age child at home, which would make it more likely that the disease comes into the house in the first place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that, you know, one of the things that we're really trying to work with in our OB community is to really educate them. And it is hard. I mean, I can tell you, I have a 9-year-old, and she did get the flu, and she was running extremely high temperatures, and I sat and held her the whole time. And so I thought to myself, if I was pregnant, how would I handle this situation? And I think the reality is that people are going to have to do something different. For example, get the aunt, get the grandmother. You know, if that pregnant mom sits there and holds that sick child, which is what we would all do in a normal situation, they are putting the baby and themselves at risk. So that child most likely is going to be sick for 3 or 4 days, and then just like mine, all of a sudden bounce back, and you're like, how could you have been so sick yesterday and today you're so active? And they'll move on, but that pregnant mom won't do that if they get the swine flu. They may be in the hospital and intubated in very critical conditions. So we really need families to work together to understand this.
Jori Klein is my guest. She's Director of Trauma and Disaster Management for the Parkland Health and Hospital System. We're talking about swine flu in North Texas. You can give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is registered nurse Jory Klein. She is director of trauma and disaster management for Parkland Health and Hospital System. We're talking this hour about swine flu in North Texas. You can be part of the conversation by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Jory, we often hear that most hospitals today, because of budget reasons and everything else and for efficiency, operate pretty much close to full most of the year, even when there is not an epidemic of any kind. What do you do when suddenly there is a greater number of people who need to be hospitalized for infectious disease?
We call that surge capacity, and that surge capacity is needed whether it's a tornado that hits or there's a major transportation incident or it's the flu. So essentially what we have in our disaster plan is a situation where once we recognize that the beds that we currently have are full, we can work with other hospitals in the community to potentially shift some of our no longer acute patients over to them, or we add additional beds. So at Parkland, for example, we have four different areas that are set up that we would switch into critical care beds. For example, if you've been to the doctor recently, let's say you went to radiology and you had a procedure done, they move you into what's called the radiology recovery room. Typically, those rooms are 8-10 patient beds, and they're set up for critical care monitoring, but they're usually not used 24/7. And so we have some significant spaces like that, our GI lab, our cardiac cath lab, our radiology recovery room, that we could probably increase 50 ICU beds fairly fast, probably within an hour to 2 hours. And then we have ward spaces that we could turn into ward beds as well. Now, what that would mean to the community is our elective procedures, we would probably stop those things. So we would be catering specifically to those involved in what we would be calling the disaster situation. So those individuals who were healthy and well but had elective procedures scheduled, we would cancel those and then reschedule those. So each hospital has a plan like that. And then we're very blessed in Dallas because we have this, we call it the DMOC, the Dallas Medical Operations Center. It's ran by Public Health under the direction of Ira Nemeth, and he's been instrumental in creating this, and John Carlo, the physician, the medical director. And so they work with all the hospitals in Dallas to look at where you're at. How many do you have? How many do you need? And it's not just beds now. We're talking about ventilators, supplies, pharmaceuticals. So the hospitals actually work together very much like a team to make sure that all the needs in Dallas County are taken care of. At a regional level, we work with 19 counties, starting with Cook County to the north, and then going all the way down to Kaufman, Waxahachie, Navarro County, and then over to Wise County on the other side of Fort Worth, down to like Somerville. So you can see it's a very large area. So at the region, we have a North Central Texas Trauma Regional Advisory Council, and they have a group that's called the Hospital Planning Group, and they bring all the hospitals. So in our region, there are over 80 hospitals that do the same thing at a regional level, and they work very closely looking at what are your resources, what are your supplies, what do you need, how do we get you what you need. They also have what we call stockpiles. So within our region, these 19 counties, there are four what we call mobile hospitals that can be set up for each one of them, can set up to manage 25 to 50 patients, depending on what type of patients you're going to be managing. And so we can really add to the surge capacity in the community. In some ways, the infectious patients is a little bit easier and in some ways more challenging. For example, if an infection patient is going to need an ICU-type environment, we can bring the monitors to that patient. So if we had to put them in the mobile hospital, we have to get the staff. Now, again, through this same process, we can identify staff. You can sign up early to work in these type of environments. We have what's called the medical core team, medical corps in our region. Again, they're volunteers. And then we also have things like the DMAT team that can be deployed in a disaster situation. In a tornado where you had like multiple injured patients that needed operations, the challenge would be to try to get those patients who needed ORs in hospitals or figure out how to make a makeshift hospital outside the community. So, again, all these plans are in place. Some of them have been well practiced, and some of them, I think this flu event has given us an opportunity to really challenge our system. And all of us are learning different things. You know, most hospitals have gone to what's called just-in-time resources, and a lot of people don't really understand that. But
it's a manufacturing term.
Absolutely. And that means that in the old days, now let's just say as a baby nurse, you'd walk into this room where there were, you know, 1,000 IVs and, you know, all the medications and all the IV supplies that you needed, and there was never a question that you had the resources that you need. And so essentially, because of dollars and cost containments, what hospitals do is they look and say, well, okay, how many patients did we take care of as an average in this month? And they begin to predict how much supplies are going to be used. And so they have enough resources in-house to usually sustain a hospital for 2 days, 3 days max. So when you start seeing the surge, then that means they usually have to start bringing in resources. And so they have contracts with their supply companies to be able to do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Emily in Richardson. Hi, Emily.
Hi. My question is, I am 3 months pregnant, and I have, you know, my OBGYN has said all the things you said about having the various vaccines, and I've had a regular flu vaccine. But I teach in a community college, and I've already had two students who've had the swine flu, and I'm sure there are others on campus. But my question, I guess, is when you say pregnant women are more at risk, does that mean we're more likely to get it, or does it mean once we, if we get it, we're more likely to have serious complications or death from it? And what exactly does it do potentially to the baby?
Thanks for your call.
Sure.
Well, let me just first say that the mom is the highest priority in a pregnancy, because if the mom is healthy, then the baby will be healthy. So typically what happens, and your questions are great, the concern for a pregnant mom is that she will get the swine flu. The swine flu, for some reason, the respiratory impact on the mom is usually, and a pregnant mom is usually significant. So if I were to get the swine flu, and I'm not pregnant, I can assure you, and if you get it at 3 months pregnant, the impact on your respiratory system will be worse than mine. So the recommendation that I have to you is this. First of all, what they're really trying to teach people is that you're exposed if that individual is within 6 feet of you. So think about your classrooms. Think about how far those individuals are from you. Those people that you know had the swine flu. There's a couple things I would just give you in recommendation to safeguard yourself. And that is just set a precedence during this disease that you're not going to have close interactions with any of your students because you don't know who's going to have it. The second issue is hand hygiene and coughing etiquette I would strongly enforce in your classroom. Those are the same things we're doing in the hospital. We have pregnant nurses in the hospital. Those are the same things we're trying to teach and to protect those nurses that are pregnant. The other thing is it sounds like you've done the right thing. You've talked to your physician. I would, you know, encourage you to have communication with him. The other thing I would do is have a plan. You said you have a small child at home. Is that correct?
That's what she said.
Then I
Emily,
would.
Hang on. Let's bring Emily back. Do you have a child at home, Emily?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I was just saying this is my first.
This is your first baby.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm around nieces and nephews occasionally, but not every day.
Okay.
I would just say at this time, I would just try to restrict any, since you don't have a child at home, I would just try to restrict all activities to protect yourself. I mean, I know that sounds terrible. You don't want to isolate yourself and stay in the home for, you know, the rest of your pregnancy. But, you know, we all know places where there's going to be children and there's going to be a risk for you. So the most important thing for you is to recognize those risks and put safeguards, put a distance between you and them to protect yourself.
Jory, you mentioned coughing etiquette. People our age, when we were kids, were taught to cough into our hands, and now that's not the way we do it.
That's correct. Again, the coughing etiquette, and I'm sure your college has signs everywhere, is to cough into your elbow, into your sleeve, so that your sleeve catches it. You know, one of the...
So your hand stays clean.
Right. I mean, today, I'll be honest with you, the common way to greet an individual in a professional environment is to shake their hands, right?
Sure.
Well, in this disease process, I would encourage you to rethink that. You know, you don't know. I mean, if they've sneezed in their hand or something like that or touched something, then you may be at risk. So I think the first thing, you know, again, cleanliness, if someone sneezes, coughs around you, if there's a way to get something to them so they can clean their hands, clean around them immediately is going to be critical.
We had an email here from Paul who wanted to know how long the virus might live on objects like doorknobs.
Well, I'm going to be honest. I don't know the exact answer to that, but I would predict it's going to be around 12 hours until that solution is completely dry, and then it's, you know. So my recommendation is all those things need to be cleaned routinely. And there's wipes that have a degermer in it, the Clorox wipes, the Lysol wipes. I'm certainly not promoting any brand names here. But all of those, you can buy them and take with you. I can tell you, I shop at Sam's a lot because I have three kids, and they have these Germ X little packets. And so every time I pick up a phone that's not my phone, I clean it with one of those. And use diligence to protect yourself. Think about this issue. The most common way to spread it is for somebody to cough with cough droplets to get on something. So if there's something that's targeted for that they may have touched with their hands, then that's going to set you up for exposure.
Let's go next on the line to Waxahachie and speak with Ed. Hi, Ed.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. First of all, I want to thank you for your service to Parkland. I know the environment you work in, and especially to the community around you, and appreciate your expertise. I had a question about the other side of the equation as far as the employees that are involved in the vaccination process. New York State has made it mandatory for healthcare providers to receive the vaccination, and I'm wondering about your thoughts about that, what that'll take place in Texas, and if you can see an opportunity for healthcare providers that are dedicated to serving the public but also have a personal choice to receive something they might not be comfortable with.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question, and our hospital actually has addressed that question, and we did a little survey to look at, you know, what everybody else is doing in Dallas County, to be honest with you. And so there is one hospital system that has made it mandatory that you have to take the flu vaccination. Our hospital system has not made it mandatory. What we have done is set a goal that 95% of our employees will either take the vaccination or they will sign what we call a declination form. A declination form says that you are concerned about side effects, or that you've had that shot in the past and did develop side effects, or for some reason you're concerned about, for example, if the virus is live and you are pregnant, or you know have some type of immune compromised system, then you can sign that declination form. Now, all Joint Commission requires hospitals to have a procedure in place to do that, so all hospitals have to have that. Our goal is to reach 95% of our employees completing that. And the reason we leave that 5% variance is because we have people that are off having babies and things like that. There are hospitals, though, who said you don't have a choice. You have to take the flu shot. If you don't take the flu shot, you have to put a mask on, and you have to wear that mask for every day that you're at work from now until the end of April. And if they do get the flu, then there's a question about whether or not they would be compensated for that. Our leaders at Parkland have taken great opportunity to educate our staff, to really reinforce why you get the shot, and to really make it an option, and to really encourage them to make healthy decisions for themselves. So our goal is going to stay at 95%.
Let's go next on the line to Maggie in Dallas. Hello, Maggie.
Hi. In mid-August, my entire family five out of six of us got the swine flu. And through different places like Presbyterian, Baylor, and Primacare, every single doctor that all of us different people as they came down went got Tamiflu. And I have two children in college. The colleges, no one is encouraging people to, one, go to the doctor, and two, to get Tamiflu. And, I mean, my kids that developed it later and we knew what was coming, they were feeling better 3-4 hours after taking the Tamiflu. And I'm just, what are they stockpiling for? Why are we not encouraging people to take the Tamiflu?
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. I just first would say that's a physician preference. The recommendations for the Tamiflu are this. If you know that you've been exposed, and usually within 48 hours, that's when the Tamiflu works the best. If you've been exposed and it's, you know, greater than 48 hours and you already are febrile from it, then the impact of the Tamiflu may not be as significant as if it would have been caught 48 hours prior, 48 hours from within exposure. So that, again, I can't speak for that, but that is a physician preference to do that. I know that our protocols, if we have somebody that's exposed to it, we will evaluate first. This is how we would define it. How close were you to that individual? Again, going back to that 6-foot perimeter. And if that individual had all the signs, febrile coughing, and it's in within 48 hours, then our protocols are to administer the Tamiflu to that individual in a prevention mode. And you're correct that the people who take the Tamiflu, if it's caught early, it usually lessens the symptoms and it decreases your what I call downtime if it's caught early. If it's not caught early, then it usually doesn't have that impact on it. And again, the other thing is a lot of people think, well, I'm just going to take the Tamiflu. The Tamiflu does not prevent you from getting the flu. It actually decreases the symptoms.
Is there enough to go around?
There's enough for all the patients that we have seen. There's multiple doses that are continuing to come in. We just, got 11,000 doses. So it really is based on what the hospital standards have been set. The CDC recommendations clearly are saying if the patient, if it is within 48 hours of the patient's exposure to someone that is documented to have this swine flu, then yes, they do recommend the Tamiflu.
So when you say exposure, the interesting thing about that is that by the time you think to yourself, you know what, I have the flu, mm-hmm. it's too late.
Right.
Okay. Let's go next on the phones to Sandra in Plano. Hi, Sandra. Hello,
yes,
Sandra.
This is Sandra, and I have a 15-year-old granddaughter who is not being cooperative about getting the flu shot because she has been exposed to people that have gotten the swine flu and the regular flu, and she feels because she's been exposed to it that if she gets the flu shot, she's going to get a worse case of the flu. So what can I tell her about getting the flu shot?
Well, there's a lot of people that have that perception. My recommendation is to, have her parents or have the doctor talk to her. Sounds like you've done a great job. The recommendation is that all of us get the flu shot. And there are people who are targeted to not get it. And those people are the individuals that I've already discussed, those people that have, immunosuppressive diseases or respiratory issues. And they need to talk to their doctor because their doctor will give them advice whether or not they should take it or they should not take it. But that should be from the physician's standpoint.
Jory Klein is here. She's the registered nurse who is director of trauma and disaster management for Parkland Health and Hospital Systems. We've got more of your calls coming up after this break. You can get to us by phoning 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jory Klein. She is Director of Trauma and Disaster Management for Parkland Health and Hospital System. We're talking about H1N1, also known as swine flu in North Texas. If you'd like to get on the phone and join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to Alan and speak with Raj. Hi, Raj.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a couple of kids at home, and I work from home at this point, so we've been able to keep them at home for the last month, kind of in isolation with all the stuff going around, swine flu in particular. Now, the question is, is that a wrong concept? If you can manage to do it for the next couple of months, just keep them away from their friends because most of them are sick all the time, and I guess the concern is we don't know what's initially, if it's swine flu or something else. Number two, once the vaccine is ready, would you recommend us waiting for a little bit before giving it for the kids, or is it? What's your recommendation on that as well?
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think you're being a smart parent. I mean, I think if more people really took responsibility, and I'm certainly not saying isolate your children and keep them home forever, but there is an epidemic going on, and so I think if you're being cautious, if you know that there are children that are ill, then I wouldn't expose my children to them. I think it's smart to keep them at home. I wouldn't isolate them to the point they don't go anywhere. And then your second question regarding the Tamiflu, you're talking about the swine flu vaccination. I would talk to your physician and. I think that I would get an appointment and be ready to get the vaccination when it comes in.
What kinds of concerns do you hear from people who are afraid of the vaccine?
Well, everywhere we go, we hear often, I've taken the flu shot before, and then I got the worst case of flu I've ever had. You know, and I just have to say, I find that hard to believe. But the bottom line is that the flu shot, there are some risks. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that there aren't risks with the flu shots. There are some complications. About 2 to 5% of individuals who take it, you know, end up with some of those complications. And so most of the people who tell you they don't want to take it, from what I can understand, is because they really haven't read all the information on it. They really don't understand that to not take it is putting them at risk. And you know, if you just talk about the seasonal flu, if you don't take the flu shot and you get the flu, you're going to be down. You're going to be off work. You're going to have to call in sick. You're going to use sick time. And most people look at it like that. But we're having an epidemic going on here. So it's not one person calling in sick. And some of the organizations and some of the schools, you've seen that, you know, the classes are empty and all the teachers are gone. So it really does have a community impact. So, again, I think it's, I would encourage everybody to talk to your physician and take the flu shot. Those individuals who have high risk, the doctors will walk them through what their options are and explain what the risks are. And the risks are really very small when you consider the impact.
To those people who report that they had a shot and then they got the flu, we should clarify that you can't get the flu shot today and then get exposed tomorrow and hope to be fully protected.
That's correct.
How long does it take?
Once you get the flu shot, it's usually going to take about anywhere from 2 weeks to a month for all that, your immune system to go into effect. And so, you know, what we typically hear is I got the flu shot and then 24 hours later I had this fever and then I was so sick. And they blame it on the flu shot. And there are some situations where anytime you get a little injection, you may have a little inflammation, a little febrile, but not like major flu-like symptoms. So a lot of it may be just coincidence that they had something going on, they took the flu shot, and then they were sick because they already had the illness in their system.
Let's go next to Jack in Dallas. Hey, Jack.
Oh, hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I have a question for you. I was traveling by airplane last night for 3 hours, sitting next to a woman who was coughing a lot during those 3 hours and appeared also to be just generally ill, actually took medication while we were sitting near each other. What would you do now that I'm back on the ground? Is there anything to do, or is it simply too late? I just have to wait it out?
Well, it sounds like it's within 48 hours. I would call my physician if you have a primary care physician and tell him that you were exposed. It does sound like you were exposed. And then they will either ask you to come into the clinic or they may decide to go ahead and give you Tamiflu over the phone. Now, the reality is if she has the flu, then the Tamiflu is going to help you. If she did not have the flu and you take the Tamiflu, then the potential for you to get sick later on may be there. So I just want to make sure you know that. That's the reason I would call your doctor and explain those symptoms to him. I will tell you that the airline industry has really taken a pretty significant stand on this in most communities. I had the opportunity to go to Japan back in June, and the health department got on the plane when we landed and searched. They asked this question, is there anybody on the plane that's had coughing, sneezing, any fever? And, of course, no one raised their hands. And they turned around and said, has anybody been sitting by anyone who's been coughing and sneezing? And several people raised their hands to really take a strong approach in trying to help those people and prevent the spread of the disease.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Julie in Grand Prairie. Hi, Julie.
Hi. My question is, I am 7 months pregnant, and so I know I'm in the high-risk category for what people recommend to get the vaccine, but my husband is really leery. He has heard some things that the swine flu vaccine was developed in a different way than the seasonal flu vaccine, and that it was developed in a way that was related to a swine flu vaccine from a long time ago, and that there were a lot of deaths related to that vaccine. So he's very nervous about me receiving the vaccine, both for the short term and then for the long term, what effect the vaccine could have on the baby. So what is your thoughts on that, and where could he go for more information to put his mind at ease, help him make a decision?
Thanks for your call. Is this the Guillain-Barre thing that happened in the swine flu in the 70s?
Mm-hmm. Guillain-Barre. It's it's a issue where your neurological system is compromised, and the mild cases of Guillain-Barré is they usually lose their ability to walk. You know, some people can stand up, but they feel weak. And then the most significant is they lose their ability to walk. And the worst case scenario is they're intubated. They can't breathe. And so this is one of the reasons why people question whether or not they're going to take the vaccination. Now, for you, what I would recommend, 7 months pregnant, I would assume that you're going to have an OB doctor's appointment fairly soon. I would recommend that you and your husband go in to see your doctor and have a counseling on that. I know that the OB-GYN doctors have gotten tremendous information and update and education on the swine flu and the vaccinations, and I would follow my doctor's recommendations.
We have a question here via email. If you get the swine flu, can you get it again?
Well, it's just like every flu you can get again. You get a different strain of it. I would think the answer is yes. I'm not an epidemiologist, so I'm not about to sit here and say I can positively say it one way or the other. But I do think that if you get a mild case, you can get a worse case. A lot of people think that you can build up the immune system. I think that there's so many strains out there that you may not get the exact swine flu case. You may just get a different type of flu. It may not be the swine flu.
Talk for a minute, Jory, about someone who's at home and hasn't been feeling great but has been taking care of themselves at home, the point at which the symptoms that would say this person needs to be in the emergency room now.
That's a great question. Well, first of all, we all drink and we all go to the bathroom, right? We would all agree on that. So what you want to watch for is an individual who begins to have fever that goes higher than 102. The second thing you want to do is to make sure that people are drinking. So a lot of people, when they're not feel good, they're like, I don't want anything to eat, I don't want anything to drink. But they must drink at least 8 glasses of water a day. So what you could do is just encourage them to drink a little bit at a time, not a whole glass. And then the third thing you want to watch for is when they go to the bathroom, are they actually, you know, keeping fluids and they're actually going to the bathroom? So are they peeing? And so that gives you a perspective, because people who have high fever and they're not drinking and they stop going to the bathroom and stop peeing or pee very little, then that tells you that they're dehydrated. And those are all clinical symptoms that they probably should see a physician. And so, again, I would encourage you to stay at home unless you have a temperature of 102 or more, number one. And if you're able to continue to drink and you can keep your fever down, I would stay at home. But the minute that you can't manage your fever, you're not able to drink, you begin to feel weak, or you're not going to the bathroom as appropriately, then I would consult my physician.
So no food's okay for a day or two if you don't feel like eating, as long as you're drinking.
Sure. We've all been on stages lately where you're like, I don't feel like eating, or, you know, you try a little chicken noodle soup. I mean, I think that's the cure for everything, to be honest with you. If they don't like the chicken noodle, at least if they can drink a little bit of the chicken broth, they'll be better off.
Okay. Let's go next on the phone to Irving, and we'll speak with Dana. Hello, Dana. Hi, Dana.
Hi. I wanted to ask, I'm someone who has diabetes and asthma, and I keep hearing, you know, nobody out of this range, you know, age range. I'm in my 40s, so I'm not in the target range. But I wanted to know, are those the kind of complications or chronic conditions that they're saying you do need to get the shot for?
Yes, I would say you need the vaccination.
We have an email here who's asking a similar question. Where can I find a vaccination location for my children? When I call the pediatrician, they say they were allocated far fewer doses than they requested and can't provide the vaccine. This is going to change within a matter of weeks,
right? It will change. There's a couple things you can do. There's a great wealth of information. I think everybody that's listening should write this down. It's called TexasFlu.com. So if you go to the website, www.texasflu.com or .org, I can't remember.
Try both.
And it has a wealth of information that will guide you through everything you need to know about the swine flu and the regular flu. So that's the first thing everybody that's listening should do that. Educate yourself. The second thing you can go is to the Dallas County Public Health website and see if they can give you recommendations on sites when you're for the flu vaccination. The third thing I would encourage you to do is your physician should be able to direct you where to go. So sometimes you're going to hear it in the clinic, sometimes the school systems. I know in Parkland, a lot of our clinics are offering that. But the bottom line is consult with your physician. If you don't have a primary care physician, a lot of that's in the newspapers, Walgreens, CVS, several of the other pharmacists around the community have offered the vaccinations. If call them up, and if they say we're out, ask them if they know where you could go to receive that. Many people are more than welcome to help you through this process.
There have been some studies out of Asia and Brazil that have been trying to find the number of asymptomatic infections. In other words, people who get exposed to the virus and somehow develop immunity but never feel sick. How long does it take to be able to study that so we can know maybe it's not as – maybe many more people are being infected but not getting seriously ill?
Oh, I predict it's going to take a while to do that. And when I say a while, I'm talking about 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. maybe even longer than that, because the real reality is – we think we know a little bit about that right now, but who is going to be the one to go up and volunteer and say, hey, I think I had the swine flu, but I didn't have any symptoms? So there's got to be tests. There's going to have to be blood draws. There are going to have to be a lot of lab procedures. The epidemiologists are clearly going to be the leaders in this, infectious disease doctors, to really look at, you know, what was the impact later on. And probably the best way to do that is to target some of those families that where you know there was incidence of swine flu. For example, one of the callers said 7 people had had it. If there's somebody in that family that perhaps had all the exposures and never really had it, it would be interesting from an epidemiology infectious disease standpoint to test that person to see, did they really have it but just didn't have any symptoms? And then why? What did they have in their system that we didn't have in our system?
You mentioned those great websites that people can go to get more current information. How do you think, how responsible has media coverage been so far? Has it been pretty accurate, or are you hearing a lot of things that are not true?
Well, I have to say in the last couple of months, I think the media in Dallas has been very good to help direct people. Again, I think anybody that has any questions, you know, we can work with the media as well to try to get information out. The Dallas County Public Health has been working with them consistently to try to send out messages for the community on the community activity of where to go for different vaccinations as well as the signs and symptoms. A lot of the websites at the hospitals now have a place where you can find something about the swine flu. So again, if you don't have a primary physician, but you typically go to, let's just say, Richardson for your health care to that hospital, check with the hospital there. Many of them have websites or information they can actually distribute to you to give you information.
In the 20 seconds or so we have left, tell us exactly what effective hand washing looks like.
Okay, that's a great question. Effective hand washing means that you actually take soap and water, put your hands under the water with the water running, put soap in your hand, and you use friction to wash your hands with for no less than 15 seconds. Now, obviously, good hand washing, it depends. Like, if you've got like 4 or 5 rings on, you got to take them off to wash them, and you got to let that water. And then what you don't want to do is turn around to the same faucets that you use dirty hands to turn on to turn off, because then you just put that stuff on you. So what you want to do, wash your hands, and then you want to get a paper towel, dry it, and use those paper towels to turn off the water.
Great advice. Tori Klein is Director of Trauma and Disaster Management for Parkland Health and Hospital System. It's been great to have you in. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.